ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We're in the mountains in Europe, where there are forests and meadows, and a 27-kilometre tunnel that scientists shoot lasers in. It's CERN, and it costs billions to build, and it's just about to be brought to a halt by a bird with a baguette. I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and in my new series for What the Duck, I'm taking on nature's most wanted, the animals that end up on the wrong side of the law. Find What the Duck on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Australia might soon be unable to replace itself. As far back as records go, Australia's fertility rate was comfortably above the level needed for births to replace deaths. In the 1960s, we had 3 births per Australian woman. Then it collapsed, and in the past 10 years, it's collapsed a good deal more. If we're to believe the latest figures, and there's some doubt, our fertility rate is now just 1.48, a good deal less than the 2.1 babies per woman thought necessary to sustain the population. China's is one. Korea's is a hard-to-fathom 0.75. It means the entire world's population is on track to peak and then start falling. Why is it happening? Why now? And how's it going to change us? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my guests, Viva Hammer, a population researcher and tax expert at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University, and Miriam Robin, who's been trying to make sense of peak humanity for readers of the Australian Financial Review, where she's a senior writer. Welcome, Viva, and welcome back, Miriam.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can I ask each of you first whether you're as weirded out by this as I am? I grew up listening to population guru Paul Ehrlich. He's just died. He was on the ABC all the time, warning that the world's population was growing exponentially by more and more each year, meaning that soon there'd be a disaster.
We have a finite planet with finite resources, and in such a system, you can't have infinite population growth.
Population growth is now slowing by more and more each year, and it's on track to turn negative. Does that weird you out, Viva?
It doesn't, I have to tell you, because the drop in fertility has been going on for about 250 years.
It was actually going on while Paul Ehrlich was saying those kind of things.
Yeah, the fertility drop has been going on for a very long time. Briefly after World War II in the Western world, fertility increased. But in fact, it began in France in the 1780s and perhaps even earlier. So those of us who have been watching this for a long time have been talking about it, and it's only now that it's become popular enough to get onto the ABC, for example. So it's not a brand new phenomenon. It had a bit of a flip after World War II, but then it's gone back to where the path has been started off a very long time ago.
Are you weirded out by the idea, Miriam? Were you like me, someone who grew up listening to what appeared to be the inevitable maths of us running out of space on the planet?
Well, this probably shows my age. So I'm in my mid-30s. So I think as far as I've been paying attention, this has not been the story. But when I do write about it, I do get a lot of feedback from readers saying, oh, good, we need to get population sustainable. So I do think there is an older generation who very much approaches this from the point of view of there are too many of us, and that's probably informed by some of those predictions we heard earlier.
Those predictions were in a book called The Population Bomb, Viva. The bomb seems to be diffusing, and probably, although many of us didn't realise it, diffusing at the time. And the diffusing has accelerated. Why has it accelerated in the last few decades?
So as I said before, it's probably just it's getting more attention than it did. And it's getting more attention because we keep having the same retirement age as we did 30, 40 years ago, but people are living much longer. So if we have an imbalance between the young, the old, and the working people, then we're going to have some kind of a social and fiscal crisis. And I think that's why we're getting much more attention on this topic. But the other reason is the numbers that you quote, 1.4 children per woman is really a bit of an average. And averages cover up lots of different things, including the fact that some women today are having what they used to have within a relationship. So a woman gets married or gets into a committed relationship and she has about two or three children. And that's been happening for a very long time within the range of having birth control. But what may be changing now and didn't happen before as much is that there are a lot more women choosing not to have children at all because they're not getting into a relationship.
It's fewer mothers overwhelms any effect you've got on the number of children per mother.
It turns out when you dig into the averages, that's what's going on. And that's a very interesting phenomenon.
Why would it be happening? Why would there be fewer mothers?
That's a really important question. And I think that it may be something to do with the fact that women can choose not to be married or not to be in a committed relationship with another man and still have enough to eat and a place to live and a pretty good life. They don't need a committed relationship to lead what they consider to be a good life, whereas maybe in the earliest time.
A woman doesn't need a man.
Yeah, and not only she doesn't need a man, but I think it's more important than that. It's that she only wants a man if he's really, really good, if he can earn a living and he can be fun and he can change the nappies. She wants all of it. And if she can't get all of it, which most people aren't all of it, then she doesn't want any of it.
But it should be, Miriam, easier to find a man than ever. We have these things called dating apps and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I think dating apps feed a very uncommon sort of fallacy around dating, which is that there's always more fish in the sea and you can always just get someone better if you keep looking. So I would argue that dating apps actually discourage the formation of committed relationships. They might increase the number of dates you go on, the number of people you meet, but there's something about just knowing that there is so much choice at your fingertips that I suspect it doesn't lead to more committed relationship. I think it actually probably does the opposite.
Well, my technology, smartphones, social media itself, in the very broad sense, be discouraging coupling because you can't couple with someone, Viva, unless you meet them. And these apps are taking, and they're introduced worldwide at the same time, so they could explain what's happening everywhere, that we're becoming less social, less keen to actually meet with someone with whom you might have a baby.
It could be that social media is making us look for something more perfect because we're seeing images and we're experiencing humans in ways they don't really appear in reality. That could be a reason why people aren't coupling, but I don't think we can diminish the importance of the fact that a woman doesn't need a man in order to lead a very, very good life. And 50 years ago, 70 years ago, and 100 years ago, you needed a couple in order to be able to afford a home, for example. So I'm not diminishing the importance of social media, but I think we have to still consider the fact that a woman's independence means that unless she gets someone really, really, really good, she'll say, I'd rather not go down that route. And if she doesn't go down that route, which is more important, she's less likely to have children. There are women who have children on their own, but it seems to be that most women want to have a child only if they have a committed partner. And if it's much harder to get one of those, then they're less likely to have children.
Miriam, might what's socially acceptable be accelerating this almost automatically in that as you have fewer people in relationships, it sort of becomes more socially acceptable to go to the movies by yourself, to not go to the movies, to even be married and not have a child?
Oh, yeah. I think there's definitely much more acceptance for the range of committed relationships or uncommitted relationships or going to the movies with a good group of girlfriends rather than a partner necessarily. I mean, I think one thing I would say, though, and this has been a sort of realization I've come across as I've gotten older is, you know, growing up, I always thought, oh, you know, some people aren't in a committed relationship, some people don't have kids, that's fine, that's what they want. But I think as I've, you know, gotten into my 30s, it's clear that for a lot of people, This is not necessarily their preference. They would like to have kids, but maybe they started too late, or they would like to be in a relationship. But, you know, economists always talk about revealed preferences, and you've got to trust what people do as well as what they say. But I think from what people say, I think a lot of people are unhappy with this outcome. And I think that's what makes it a little bit sad, quite apart from the economic consequences of not enough children.
Viva, might norms be feeding into this, amplifying it in another way, in that if there are fewer children, there are fewer parks, there are fewer expectations to build, that there'll be schools in new suburbs and so on?
Yeah, I think once you start down the path of childless societies, and Korea is the emblem of that, then it becomes more and more odd to be in a world with children. I mean, that's the same thing as every other norm. If it becomes abnormal to have red shoes, then when you walk down the street with red shoes, it's going to be a strange thing to do. If you walk down the street with three children in Korea, I'm sure it turns heads. In fact, I met a Japanese woman at an airport once with five children. And I said to her, what do your friends think? And she said to me, they think I'm mad. So once you begin the path that children are an oddity or a rarity, then the choice to have them, even if you really want them, and even if you are in a committed relationship, becomes a mad choice and therefore even less likely to be chosen.
And this would explain China's continuation of a low birth rate even after the one-child policy ended, because a new normal had been established. We should point out, by the way, that the one-child policy, everyone talks about that as having a big effect, but Taiwan, which did not have the one-child policy but had similar families, also experienced the same sort of decline in birth rate at the same time. These are only some of the potential explanations for the shift in population growth that's upon us almost everywhere. If you've got another one, we'd love to hear from you here on The Economy is Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin. My guest this week, population researcher Viva Hammer and Miriam Robin from the Australian Financial Review. Miriam, what's it going to mean for us and the world? It's certainly going to change the makeup of the world. Nigeria is expected to overtake China to become the world's second most populous nation after India by the end of the century. China's population is expected to halve by then. How will it change the sort of societies those and other nations have, including us? How bold we are, what we value?
Well, it'll probably have all sorts of effects, most of which we're yet to see, because I don't think this has really been the experience of humanity to this point. But, you know, people have hypothesized about this a lot. And some things are that, you know, there's different types of intelligence. So there's kind of intelligence that's very, you know, fluid, and that ends up with bringing up new inventions, totally radical new ways of approaching things. And then there's intelligence that's more informed by experience and deep understanding. And older populations have...
You're saying here I've got the second kind, and maybe once I had the first, maybe.
Oh, you know.
And if an entire population ages, you get into the second kind of intelligence, which is sort of administrative rather than creative, rather than inventing new things.
Maybe it stops you making big mistakes, but yes, it probably does stop you inventing new things as well. You know, I think that can take place in the economy and science or even in culture. And you could look at our willingness to celebrate remakes or retellings of stories we already know instead of embracing new ones as an early indicator of this, perhaps.
Would it mean we're less able to defend ourselves? I mean, physically, obviously, because you need soldiers to have an army, but we're less sort of aggressive as well as being less innovative.
Well, society as a whole has become a lot safer in recent decades, and I think that's a great thing, right? That's really good. But, you know, wars kill a lot less people and there's just less violence around as well. So, you know, it's not, an aging population isn't all bad. But yeah, I think it will lead to quite a different type of society.
How do you see it changing things, Viva?
We don't yet know, and aging has become a positive in the sense that we are much more capable of doing things as we get older than we were even 20 years, 30 years ago. My mother's almost 19. She's at the gym every day. She has a personal trainer. She travels the world. That's not a normal thing even today for a 90-year-old, but it may become normal. What won't change, what so far we haven't seen change, is that the fertility range of a woman, which is considered to be between the age of 15 and 45, despite the fact of enormous amounts of investment, that age range hasn't changed. So if a woman feels like she can't have a child till she makes a partner in her law firm or until she is able to buy a house, that may not be till she's 42, at which point she's almost certainly missed her chance to have a child. So although we're aging in a very positive way, our wombs have not changed their ability to generate new life. We're certainly healthier as we get older, but our wombs have not moved with the times, so to speak.
Might this be sort of okay, Miriam? I ask that because a world where we value workers more, and we'll have to value workers more because there'll be fewer of them, fewer in the prime working age group. A world where we're less aggressive, more complacent, maybe that's what we're aiming for. Maybe that's what we've been trying to achieve all of this time, an affluent world where it's okay, you don't need to strive. I think of the Billy Joel song, Vienna, just get used to it. It's okay, you've strived. Life is okay and you can go on living. Might it be that this is in fact not so bad?
Look, we're going to have to get used to it because some measure of this is baked in already. So, you know, this will be our world for the foreseeable future. I think some of the negatives, economic growth, for instance, in first world countries, it can be very closely tied to population growth. There have been economists who've looked at the difference, say, between the United States and Japan from the 80s to now. And they're like, look, they've both grown at roughly the same rate per capita. The problem is that Japan has had a very strongly falling population and America has not. So now the economic differential between the two is very large. So you probably do get poorer if there are fewer people. For individuals in these societies, though, the effects can be quite complicated. So if you look back to, say, the Black Death in the 1400s in Europe, that led to a very rapid fall in the number of working age people who were mainly agricultural labourers. What ended up happening is that there was this huge pressure for wages to rise, and the sort of landowning class didn't want them to rise. So that led to a whole lot of political revolutions and tension in that. But if there's fewer working age people, their wages have to go up.
So just as the Black Death gave us workers, our first really big pay rise, probably in all of humanity, we might be seeing that again. These are important questions to consider as we look forward to the next few decades on The Economy Stupid with me, Peter Martin, on ABC Radio National, and guests this week discussing our falling birth rate. Deaths are on track to overtake births, though it'll still take a while. Economist Viva Hammer and economic writer Miriam Robin. Viva, could we change this even if we wanted to? The government's baby bonus, Australia's baby bonus, worked for a while. There was an uptick in births in the first decade of this century, but then they fell again. Are there things governments can do to bring about more births, assuming that's what we want?
You know, the governments all over the world have tried every single turkey in the pot or vegetable in the pot, cars, houses, bribes of all kinds to get people to have children. Some of them have worked in the short term, as you say, but none of them have worked in the long term. The only reason people have children, as far as I can tell, after having interviewed women with large families for over 20 years, is because they have a reason to do so, a story that they tell themselves about why they live and why they continue life. A government cannot tell you why you live and why it's worth investing in future life rather than in your own pleasures. The short answer is none of them work if they don't involve some strong values about why we have, why life is worth living and what the meaning of life is. That's what makes people have children, nothing to do with an extra car or an extra house or any of those other things.
Miriam, do we know what happened when Treasurer Peter Costello introduced the $3,000 so-called baby bonus in 2004.
Yeah, so, you know, Viva's right, nothing's worked, which is what makes the Australian case, even though it was a short-term success, quite strange and of quite a lot of interest to policymakers, is that the birth rate did go up. It went up quite a bit, and economists looking retrospectively reckon there's 24,000 Australians alive because of it. So, and it had a particularly notable effect on women having their third child. So women who were already mothers, who kind of knew what it was like and who were like, well, okay, I can make this work. I interviewed Peter Costello about this recently, and he's very proud of it, but he also does grapple with this idea that, like, hey, it probably wasn't the money, because it's kind of insane that if you consider the huge investment you have to make in every child, that a couple of $1,000s would make that big a difference. He thinks it was because the conversation around the intergenerational report, people felt like they were doing the right thing by having a child, that they would be socially supported for doing so. And he also points out that the economy was going quite well at the time. So he thinks it was a cultural conversation, and this probably had more of an impact on people than just the money, which wasn't all that much in the end.
Viva, if money won't work, will immigration paper over the problem? Australia seems to be able to take in about as many people, a good deal more people, than it needs. Naturally, the whole world can't do that. The entire globe can't take in people, but we can. Is this a reasonable way around things, to the extent that not having working age people causes us problems?
Immigration is at best a short-term solution. As you point out, the world has a limited supply of children, and the question is who gets to have them. So our major sources of immigration are China and India. China, of course, has very few children altogether, and India has just recently hit slightly below replacement. Both those countries will no doubt keep having fewer children. We can get access to them because we offer an extraordinary lifestyle and a very beautiful country. But that's not a long-term solution if they also don't have any children. The other problem with immigration is the people who arrive start having the same number of children than the locals. And that happens all over the world. So even if you come from a country with large numbers of children, for example, Africa or the Middle East, when you arrive in Australia or in America or Canada, you very quickly move to the norm of the place where you live. So you could bring in a young couple, hopefully they'll have some children, but they're going to end up having the number of children that the Australian population has, which is 1.4.
Miriam, you've actually looked at the birth rate of immigrants, and is this true that immigrants not only have about the same number of births per woman as Australians who were there before them, but somewhat fewer?
So this was an analysis by KPMG, and they looked at, in Australia, they looked at how many children do women born in particular countries have. And what they tended to find is there's sort of two effects going on, is that people are affected by the birth rate of the country that they were born in, that they have immigrated from, but actually they tend to undershoot it a bit when they migrate. So we have a lot of migrants from East Asia, which is not an area where they have very large families, but also when they come here, they tend to have fewer children than people from Australia. So I think, like, if you look at Chinese migrants, for instance, the figure is 0.8 per woman here. So I think there might be a couple of effects to that. It might be that when people migrate, they focus very hard on establishing a career and sending money home, and they're not really putting the investment into the next generation. Or if they are, they want to invest very heavily in one child and not many. Another one might just be that when they come here, they don't have the familial support networks that locals have. And so that makes them reluctant to have many children. So I think it actually, you know, there's this perception, I think, that migrants come and, oh, they're going to have all these kids, they're going to have so many more kids than the native-born population. It's really not true in Australia. In fact, they have considerably fewer.
Well, Viva, if not immigration as a solution, and if not government bribes, what other sort of creative ideas might there be? France is sending out letters to everyone who turns 29, telling them, well, it's in French, but it is time to reflect on whether or not to have a child. We could stop global warming. That would make people feel better about bringing children into the world. Another idea, we could encourage working from home, especially for men. I read somewhere you can't get pregnant by text message. What bold ideas are there? The, that might work?
I don't think the governments are ever going to be the source of an increased birth rate. The government is a far too remote and not particularly trustworthy source of anything. What's going to have to happen is that people in small groups, whether you call it a mother's club, a religion, a sports club, small groups of people make decisions like this about why they want to have children and that they enjoy doing it together. The government really can't do anything about making childbearing and child rearing something you do together with other people.
What ideas do you have, Marion?
Oh, look, I'm sorry to you know, duck this one as well, but I really think this is a social, cultural and moral issue. Having children is it's a very rare choice for our society in that it's this kind of irrevocable thing that once you do it, you can't ever take it back. You can't do something different. You can't cease to be a father or a mother. And it's very hard to imagine how it will change your life. And I think it's very easy to see the costs, and it's almost impossible to grapple with the huge psychic benefits of it. So you kind of have to take the plunge trusting that it will work out. And I don't think as a society we are very good at that type of decision making. And I think that's probably some of what's tripping us up now.
It's a bit like marriage, I suppose, in that you have to go into that with faith or with your eyes closed and hope for the best, except that marriage is reversible. It probably, as you say, is the last decision, which is a one-off decision that can't be undone. And these days, we're not presented with those, are we?
No, it is uniquely, it calls for something unique from people, I think.
Do you think we're at all ready for the kind of world that we'll have, Viva, or the kind of world that on present birth rates will have?
I think that they come upon us very, very slowly, like global warming. We are already in there. The average age of people in almost every society is much older than we've ever seen before. But I'm not negative on it. I think that could be very interesting to see older people participating differently from how they've done in the past. No government and no sub-government, I think it can change that course that we're on. We just have to adapt to a world with older people.
Before we go, Miriam and Viva, as is traditional on this program, anything to look out for in the weeks and months ahead? Miriam.
I read a piece recently written by the Financial Review's North Asia correspondent, Jess Sire, about the rise of AI boyfriends in China. And what struck me was just we cannot imagine, I think, in Australia, the sophistication and the emotional nuance of some of these models. They sort of recognise that people don't just want to take from AI, they also want to give. So you can have an AI boyfriend and you'll buy his parents' dyed pack, and then you add that and you have to coach the AI through that emotional situation, and people benefit from that. And I think they seem to be getting really, really good and really, really interesting. And you know, the one thing an AI boyfriend can't give you, of course, is a child. So I'd be watching the rise of AI companions.
Viva, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead?
Yes, I think that we're seeing some new research on the societies that still do have very high fertility. For example, the Amish in the US, we are going to see more of them in the future by definition. Those of us who don't have children will not be represented in the future. Those who do will be. And so we're going to see a lot more of the Amish, Hutterites, Hasidim, Muslims in the future, because they're the ones who are having children. And I think we need to be looking at the values that those communities promote amongst themselves and see how it is that they are encouraging people to have more children. And they are going to be represented in the next generation. The AIs will be a short-term thing. Obviously, they can't produce children. In the future, we're going to see the populations who do produce children, and they're going to be occupying the earth.
Viva Hammer, population researcher at the Crawford School of Public Policy, and Miriam Robin, senior writer for the Australian Financial Review. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, especially about population and plummeting birth rates, no economic question is stupid. You can email us at theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. We can't wait to hear what you've got to say. Thanks to producer Hayley Crane. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.